1 Samuel chapter 17. David facing Goliath, familiar territory. In the beginning of the chapter, Goliath is described in a great bit of detail. His armor, his spear, his helmet, over 200 pounds of armor. About 10 foot tall. Not a big skinny guy. 10 foot tall Arnold Schwarzenegger. A big man, 1,000 pounder. A lot of beef on the hoof. Coming out into the valley of Elah every day to defy the armies of Israel. 40 days and 40 nights, morning and evening, crying, "Isn't there a man among the children of Israel defiant?" And again, as I look at the chapter, I'm troubled in one sense. Very familiar territory. We've been heard the story from the time we're little. We've been hearing the story. And again, it's not that it's there so that we can say, "Oh, you know what, I have forgotten how much I love the story. In fact, I'm going to go home and read this to the grandkids tonight." This is just, I'm afraid that it's there because all of our lives go through 1 Samuel chapter 17 at some point or another. And that all of us face some insurmountable thing, some adversary, some struggle, some giant. Certainly not a 10-foot guy with armor. Hopefully not. But something in our heart, in our mind, in our lives, in our family. Some obstacle, some thing that taunts us morning and evening, day and night. Often something that we can't even share with someone else, that we keep within, that we never seem to get victory over. I think we need to remember as we go through the chapter that the first thing it tells us is that it takes place at Ephes-Damon, which is, very interestingly, the border of blood. And we need to remember that whatever giant comes our way, whatever adversary intimidates us, that we're bought with a price. The evil one touches us not. That God has drawn a line in the spiritual sand, which is the border of blood, that no adversary can step over and have at us. We are sealed with the spirit of promise until the day of redemption. And the enemy works most often in the realm of fear and anxiety and lying and wearing down our faith. David, a rebuke to all of us, a stripling he's called, a young kid, comes to the battle line to bring supplies to his older brothers. Three of them are there. And it just so happens as David gets there, the tribe of Judah is always on the front lines. He runs up, and just as that's happening, here comes the giant. Tung, tung. Chunk, rattling and glistening, and out into, and David looks and he hears this giant defying the armies of the living God. And David said, "Who is this guy? This guy?" I said, "Well, that's Goliath, the champion of Gath, and he's coming out to defy us, to challenge us. And Saul has said, if anybody goes out and fights him and defeats him, that he'll enrich him greatly, give him his daughter in marriage, and make his father's house tax exempt in Israel." And David says, "Come at me again, would you please? You mean that the motivation that Saul has to give you guys is monetary? He's going to give you money and his daughter and tax exemption? What about the reputation of the living God, the God who parted the Red Sea, the God who brought us out of Egypt, the God who led us with a pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire? What about the God who parted the Jordan River, that brought us in here, that brought down the walls of Jericho, that made the sun stand still in the valley of Ajalon? You guys are doing this for money. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he comes out to defy the armies of the living, and that's where David lived, the living God? Well, his older brother, Eliab, hears him spouting off and gets mad and says, "Get out of here. You're supposed to be watching the sheep. I know why you're here, you punk kid." And it's difficult to be the youngest of eight brothers. You know, "You're just here to see blood. I know why you're here." And David says, typical brother argument, "What have I done now? What did I do this time?" And he turns away from Eliab, like family do when they're in an argument, just ignoring his older brother, and starts talking to someone else. And word comes to Saul. There's this kid out here spouting off that he wants at this giant. Saul says, "Bring him in." He comes in to Saul and Saul says, "You can't fight this giant, you're but a youth. This man's been a warrior from his youth." David said, "Chill, Saul. I was out in the field. Bear came to attack the flock. I killed him. Lion came, took one of the sheep in his mouth. I chased him, grabbed him by his beard, slew him. And this uncircumcised Philistine, he'll be just like the lion or the bear because of the God who delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear will deliver this uncircumcised Philistine into my hand also, the God." Saul listens to that, no doubt. Emotions are stirred within him that he had long forgotten about. Maybe remembering Samuel, the power of God, he says to David, "Will you go then?" He says, "But come back here, let me take care of you," and puts on his helmet and his breastplate and his sword. And David's a kid, and Saul's 7 foot tall, and David's chunking around with this stuff. It says he tried to walk, and he couldn't even go. And he says to Saul, "I can't fight in your armor. I haven't proved this stuff." So David heads then down into the valley. Now you have to imagine, the Philistines are on one side. Their champion's been going out every day. They're out there shouting and carrying on because the Israelites are cowards. And they send out Goliath again. They're out there, whatever they yell at them, I don't know. And the Israelites are looking, and here goes this little kid with a stick in his hand walking out into the battlefield. Most of them are going, "What?" And Eliab and Jesse's three sons are going, "Dad is going to kill us. I can't believe he got involved in this." And it says in verse 40, he took his staff in his hand and he chose 5 smooth stones out of the brook and put them into a shepherd's bag, which he had, even a scrip, a leather pouch, and his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. Everyone likes to make the point that he took 5 stones because Goliath had 4 brothers. We'll find that out in 2 Samuel 18. Figured he'd take care of them all, I guess, while he was out there. Again, I think the amazing thing is, for those of you who have been there, that the brook is in the center of the valley, that David didn't even have ammunition until he was fully committed. It wasn't until he was all the way out there with the giant that he could pick up the stones and put them in his bag. And I can imagine what Goliath's thinking, this little skinny kid's running around the edge of the brook picking up stones. "Nah, not that one. Yeah, that one." And David hadn't read the chapter. That's another thing we always have to keep in mind. David's not saying to the army of the Israelites, this is the favorite chapter of my life. Wait till you see this. This is going to be great. He drew near to the Philistine. Verse 41 says, "And the Philistine came on and drew near unto David. And the man that bare the shield of Goliath went before him." And imagine now, the armies have been watching for 40 days. There's been no one coming out to challenge Goliath. And now this little kid's out there. Now you have to understand, this is like Shaquille O'Neal fighting Shirley Temple. This is not a contest. This is murder in the minds of these armies. There's no contest here. And everybody must be thinking, what is this all about? You know, if they thought that then, I don't know. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth. He was ruddy, reddish hair, good-looking little kid, fair countenance. And the Philistine said unto David, Fee, fi, fo, no. The Philistine said unto David, Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said unto David, Come to me. Now I imagine he had quite a billowy voice, and they could hear him in that valley. Come to me, and I will give thy flesh unto the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field. Then said David to the Philistine, You should have stayed in bed, you big dummy. Now, that's I'm giving you the sense of it here. Then said David to the Philistine, You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. And I have to believe that God's on his throne going, Yes! After 40 days, finally, I got somebody out there. All I needed was somebody that breathes. David. This day will the Lord deliver you into my hand, and I will smite you. This is what Goliath had said to him. I'm going to take your head from off you, and I'll give not just your carcass, but the carcasses of the whole host of the Philistines this day into the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. God's going, Yes! That's what he's trying to convince his own army, the army of Israel, that there's a God in Israel. And all this assembly shall know. Now, David's motivation is much different. That the Lord saveth not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. David not entering into the flesh with this. You come to me with a sword and a spear. That's not what this is about. At all. This is about the living God and about his reputation. David is not going to enter the contest for victory. David is entering the contest from victory. David has already won all the preliminary battles again. He won the battle of eight older brothers who told him he was nothing. He was a zero. He was just a kid. Get out of here. Get off the battlefield. And how our family often treats us like that, those closest to us, a prophet not without honor except in his own house. That's a tremendous battle for us to win, to believe the word of God against all of the voices that may surround us. He had won the second battle when the expert says, You can't fight him. You're just a kid. He's a warrior from his youth. That's a tremendous battle for us to overcome when the experts tell us that we're unqualified. You don't have a degree on your wall. You can't do this. You can't serve God. No, David had won that battle. David had won the third battle when Saul said, this is how professional giant killers do it. Here's a helmet. Here's the armor. Here's a sword. This is how the professionals do it. David had already won that battle. No. This has nothing to do with professional giant killers. If there was a professional giant killer here, he'd already be out there. David had won all the preliminaries. At this point, all he has to do is throw the stone. Because he's fighting from victory. He's standing on his own relationship with the living God. The same God that took me out of the paw of the bear and out of the paw of the lion will deliver this uncircumcised Philistine into our hands. You come to me with a sword, with a spear. I come unto you in the name of the living gods, and God's going to deliver you into our hands today so that all the world might know that there is a God in Israel. And we don't even know if his voice has changed yet. You come to me with a spear. You know, he's just a kid. He's a kid. And it came to pass, when the Philistine arose, now he must be mad. Now David says, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to cut your head off, I'm going to destroy all your armies. This kid with a stick. Yeah? You know. So it came to pass when the Philistine arose and came and drew nigh to meet David, that David hasted. He hurried and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. Goliath hasn't seen this in years. He takes a move towards David, and David comes at him. Yeah! This little kid running at him. I mean, you know, we're told, remember in Joshua 11, that all of the Anakim had been destroyed in the land of Israel, except in Gath, in Gaza, and in Ekron. The sons of Anak were still there, and here is one of these giants. When the children of Israel wanted to come into the land, in Numbers chapter 13, it said, we were like grasshoppers in our own sights and in their sights. The sons of Anak, the giants are there, and the whole nation of Israel turned away. They were afraid. Here's one kid. You know, if I'm out there when Goliath starts coming at me, I'm looking for some strategic position, like behind a rock or on an airplane going another direction or something. David is just in the zone. David just runs at him as David moves faster towards him than he moves towards David. And David put his hand into his bag. He took from there a stone and slang it. I like King James. That's the end of Goliath. He just slang it. And it hit the Philistine in his forehead, that the stone sunk into his forehead, and he fell upon his face to the earth. You have to understand, there's nothing else that could possibly have happened at this point in time. Because all of the Philistine army has heard about the living God of Israel. All of the armies of Israel have been reminded that God is in the battle. The battle belongs to the Lord. Doesn't matter. They haven't heard anyone talk like this for years. God couldn't do anything else. There's this little kid out there that's advertised his glory all over this valley. David goes out there. God's saying, just get it out of the sling so I can kill the giant, please. You know, David could have just went, yeah, and shot it up in the air when it came down and hit him on the head and killed him. He could have just, woo, shot it backwards. It went around the world and hit him in the back of the head and killed him. He could have just shot it at the ground. It would have ricocheted off the ground and killed him. There was nowhere else that stone could possibly go. The Holy Ghost was all over it, but into the forehead of Goliath. It was impossible. Because God's glory was at stake. This little kid advertised him all over, and this little kid is standing in faith, running at this giant, whips this stone around in the sling, and he just lets it go. He didn't even have to aim. Sinks in the Goliath's forehead. You see this guy fall down onto his knees and his face, boom, on his knees, and then ka-chung, all this dust come up, you know. And the Philistine army must be thinking, oh, that kidder Goliath. He's going to grab the kid by his ankle and go, boom, 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 boom. And I'm sure that the Israelites were thinking, David, get out of there. He's going to be mad when he gets up. He fell upon his face to the earth. Now you can imagine all of the armies are dead silent. And Goliath's laying there, smoke's coming up. David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling, with a stone, and smote the Philistine and slew him. But there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran and stood upon the Philistine. He climbs up on top of Goliath. And took his sword and drew it out of the sheath. David grabs it and runs. Takes his big sword out of the sheath. And he slew him and cut off his head. Now at this point, everybody knows Goliath ain't getting up. David probably lifts the sword in the air and says, next to the Philistine army. It says the Philistines head for the hills. That's what it says in the Hebrew. Look in verse 51. And when the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. And the men of Israel and of Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines. They're real brave now, aren't they? But you know, Sometimes it only takes one kid. Sometimes it only takes one woman, one man. Again, you know, 2 Chronicles gives us the verse, and I'm sure it was written with this scene in mind, that the eyes of the Lord go to and fro throughout the earth, the whole earth, seeking those whose heart is perfect towards Him, that He might show Himself strong on their behalf. That was written in the era of this incident. And sometimes it just takes one to ignite a revival, to ignite the entire army. Remarkably now, for the first time they had heard, they know the Lord has joined the battle. They've witnessed the miracle, and the armies of Israel are encouraged. They begin to pursue the Philistines until you come to the valley and into the gates of Ekron. And the wounded of the Philistine fell down by the way of She'arim, even unto Gath and to Ekron. And the children of Israel returned from chasing after the Philistines, and they spoiled their tents. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. So David goes into his tent. He's got the head of a lion, head of a bear, head of a giant there. Now he took his armor into his tent, probably hung a sling over it. That looks good, just like that. Hang the sling there, you know. And Saul, verse 55, saw David go forth against the Philistine. He said to Abner, the captain of the host, "Abner, whose son is this youth?" Abner said, "As thy soul liveth, O king, I cannot tell." Now take note of this, because everybody asked the question, how is it that Saul couldn't know David? If David had played the harp there to soothe him, if David had been his armor bearer for a period of time, well, it doesn't say that Saul didn't know David. Saul asked Abner, "What family is he from again? Whose son is this youth?" He asked now of David's family. No doubt he had many armor bearers and many young men in his court. What he is impressed with this time is this victory, and desiring then to make David a permanent part of his court, now he's asking Abner, "Whose son is this? What family is he from?" And the king said, "Inquire thou whose son this stripling is." And as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul, look, with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, "What are you doing walking around with that disgusting thing?" No, that's not what he said. What does David do? David's wandering around now with this head. You know, it's got to be big too, man. Took it to his tent. Now he's walking around, coming to Saul. He's hanging on to it. Saul said to him, "Whose son are you?" I want to tell your dad, he should tell you to get rid of that. "Thou young man." And David answered, "I am the son of thy servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." Very interesting chapter in the life of David, not in the Bible, but in his own life, because he comes to the point now of national recognition. Samuel had come and poured the anointing oil of God upon him, told him, Josephus tells us that he bent over and said, "Thou art the king of Israel." However much time has elapsed, David now, as in love with the Lord as he ever was, stands in the gap on behalf of God. God grants a tremendous victory. National recognition comes to David. He's brought into the court of Saul. And no doubt he thinks at this point, "God, I see your design. Killed a giant, put my name in the headlines, bring me into Saul's court where I can learn about government. You know, this is a great plan, God." Well, it's going to be 15 more years before David will ascend the throne. David's somewhere 15 to 17 at this point. And in those 15 years, he begins a downward spiral of persecution, of heartbreak, of, again, what Alan Redpath titles his book, of the making of a man of God. Tozier said, "I doubt whether God can use a man greatly until he hurts him deeply." And David will have everything stripped away of natural ability, of friendship, of counselors. And he'll be reduced to what he was as a youth in the fields, nothing but a harp, looking once again to the God of heaven, and begin the long process of God teaching him and instructing him, though he's the anointed king. Saul is the apostate king. Saul's the one who's in rebellion. David is the apple of God's eye. David is the youth that stood up for God's glory. And yet, when you look at what's going on in his life, we come to that difficulty of, God, you love me. You tell me I'm your son or I'm your daughter, that your affections are set upon me, that you love me so much you gave your only son. Why do I go from heartache to heartache, from difficulty to difficulty? Lord, what is it that you're doing in my life? And David, of course, being given at least five times as many chapters as any other character in the Old Testament, we have this long picture of David's life, frame by frame, of the work of God. And a very interesting process begins at this point, as David no doubt thinks that he has come within grasp of the throne, not that he was wanting to grasp it, but it's within view, and yet all of that would be removed. Chapter 18 says this, "And it came to pass, when he had made an end of speaking unto Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David. And Jonathan loved him as his own soul." And the reason is because they're like-hearted. Jonathan is the one when one of the greatest gatherings of Philistine forces had come into the land, who said to his armor-bearer, "Let's go up. Who knows what God might do? Let's just go, you and I. And we'll go up there and challenge him. And if the Philistines say this, then we know we better get out of here. But if they say this, we'll just go up and get them." And his armor-bearer, crazy as he is, said, "Whatever you think, Jonathan, you and I will go fight 6,000 soldiers, no problem." And Jonathan sees that like-heartedness in David. And immediately his soul is knit to him, and he loves David. And no doubt he's heard by this point that Samuel had come. Because we're going to hear by conversations they have in the succeeding chapters that Jonathan already knows that David would be king. Jonathan already knows that Samuel's come to Bethlehem. Jonathan already knows some things are cooking here. He loves David as his own soul. "And Saul took him that day and would let him go no more home to his father's house." Evidently then talking to the family, giving them their tax exemption because of what David had done, asking official permission to bring David into the court and to raise him there. Verse 3 says, "Then Jonathan and David made a covenant." And we're not given the details of it, because he loved him as his own soul. "And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him, which was the signature of his royalty." He was the heir to the throne. "And gave it to David, and his garments, even to his sword and his bow and to his leather belt." What Jonathan is doing here is Jonathan is bowing the knee to God's will. He realizes David is the heir to the throne, not by blood, but by God's decree. "Yes, I'm heir to the throne by blood, but God, this is your man." And he takes off his royal robe and gives it to David. We're not told if he does that in the court in front of his father or not. Gives him his sword, gives him the signatures of royalty. And I look at that and I think, you know, Jonathan in some ways is one of the most remarkable characters in the scripture. What cost are we willing to incur to see God's will fulfilled around us? What payment? What thing? And what greater thing, in a sense, could Jonathan give but his right to the throne? Just is willing to bow the knee before God's will and say, Lord, I'm just a servant, just a slave. It's your will. And give all the signatures of royalty to someone who is only third generation from a Moabite grandmother. And the remarkable thing, it says that a Moabite that married an Israelite, that their children weren't allowed to even enter into worship till the 10th generation. David is only the third generation from Ruth. And yet, he's going to be the king. He's going to stand and worship. And I think, Lord, you know, what cost am I willing to pay for your will? What even little things am I willing to give in the course of my day? What thing am I willing to lay down, Lord, to draw closer? Am I willing to set my alarm clock a half hour earlier in the morning to get up and spend time alone with you? Am I willing to step aside, whatever the cost, to see your will go forward? No, great challenge. A man that no doubt will be wonderful to meet as we come into the kingdom. And David went out, and whithersoever Saul sent him, and he behaved himself wisely. And Saul set him over the men of war, and he was accepted in the sight of all the people, and also in the sight of Saul's servants. Now it says he was accepted, no doubt because he's still a youth, but he's accepted by the people. It says that he behaved himself wisely. Throughout the chapter, we're going to read this. Look over in verse 14, and you'll see that there's an addendum to it here. He behaved himself wisely, then it says, in all his ways. Look in verse 15. He behaved himself now very wisely. And then if you look over in the end of verse 30, David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so that his name was much set by. We see David growing here. And each time it says that he behaved himself wisely, your translation may say he prospered. It's the theological word, shakal, from the book of Deuteronomy, that those who yielded to God, that those who kept his commandments and walked within his ordinances would shakal, would prosper. And it isn't of natural ability, and it isn't of anything David understood to do in the natural. What it's telling us through this chapter, and it says three times at least, that Saul saw the Lord was with David. It's because David was correct theologically, as it were, through this chapter. His heart is before God. You know, Saul is telling him, you're my armor bearer, and David's saying, I only do giants. When you got giants, let me know. I don't carry around anybody's clunky armor. And we don't hear any of that from David. David never chafes under submission to the position that God gives him. And in all that he does, he behaves himself wisely, or he prospers, and it's the hand of God that's upon his life. And it came to pass, verse 6, as they came, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, that the women came out of all of the cities of Israel, singing and dancing, to meet King Saul with the tabrets, with joy and with instruments. This is the culture. They come out singing. And the women answered one another as they played and said, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands. This becomes a number one hit in Israel. And remember, David, very common to us, very common name, David, in our culture. This is the first person in the Bible named David. It wasn't a common name when they sang this song. David was a rare name, as far as we know. It means the beloved. And he is a type of his greater son, Jesus Christ, that would come. They're singing, Saul has slain his thousands, David has slain his tens of thousands, and Saul was very wroth, and the saying displeased him. Now, verse 8 says he was very wroth. It's very interesting. You look that up in a concordance. The word wroth, it speaks of a slow burn. Saul begins to cook now. A slow burn begins, heartburn. He produces acid in his stomach now. The process begins. It is remarkable what envy and jealousy can do to the human frame. Saul begins now with a slow burn, it says. And the saying displeased him, literally was evil in his eyes. And he said, they have ascribed unto David 10,000s, and unto me they've only ascribed thousands. And what can he have more but the kingdom? Now, this is a picture of one man in decline and another man being raised up. The man in decline has a much easier life. He'll remain in the palace. He has all of the luxury. He has the army. He has the power. He has a place of rest. He has a home. David is the man who's being raised up, and he has nothing but hardship. We'll watch this process. But the interesting thing is Saul is slowly losing his mind. The Spirit of the Lord has departed. No longer is God's anointing upon his life. The Spirit of God is on David's life. And in all of David's trouble, David finds rest in his Lord. Saul finds no rest with all of the natural advantages. And we see it today, again, in our society with millionaires and Betty Ford Clinic. They have everything going for them that people think that you should have going for them, and they get ulcers and they become alcoholics. How many times do we see professional athletes that are making millions of dollars busted for cocaine? And so many other people are sitting around thinking, well, if I had what they had, I'd be happy. Oh, no. No, no. Human being thirsts for something that is much greater than money or success. There's a thirst in all of us for the living God. And David will drink deeply in his hardship. And Saul is shallow, and he's empty, though he has every natural ability. James will say it this way, cleanse your hands, you sinners. Stop doing the things that you're doing. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. That's the way they said schizophrenic in that day. Double-minded. Two personalities. And James says the heart of the problem is the problem of the heart. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, but purify your hearts, you double-minded. Saul one day is going to be saying, I swear, Jonathan, I'll never touch David. The next day, he's throwing spears at him. And then he's saying, oh, this is wrong, forgive me, David. Then the next day, he's trying to kill David again. And he's two people. He's going back and forth. And it's because his heart is so wrong. And even in the process, I believe that anywhere along here, though Saul has sinned with Amalek back in chapter 15, though Samuel has said to Saul, God now, as he ripped Samuel's garment, Samuel said, Saul, God is ripping the kingdom away from you and giving it to someone else. I believe with all my heart that if Saul would have taken a sucking lamb and gone to the altar and sacrificed and got on his knees and said, God, forgive me. I will do everything that I can do to support David. I will give him the throne. Lord, only let me be your servant. I believe that God would have blessed Saul and he would have been next to the throne of David his entire life and flourished there. But instead of that, because there's idolatry in his heart, and he refuses to let go of something that was never rightfully his in the first place, but it was given and granted, we see this man disintegrating and falling apart. Verse 9 says, Saul eyed David. That doesn't sound good, does it? Gave him the evil eye. From that day forward. And it came to pass on the morrow that the evil spirit from God came upon Saul. We talked to, you know, God has removed his spirit. Saul is prey to whatever influence is around. And so are we. When we're unsaved. Once we're saved, and Saul's not in that condition, we're sealed, we're protected. But there are spirits that at work. I have a very interesting photograph, if you remember when the thing happened at Columbine High School. And on the cover of the magazine, there's a picture of Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, clean-cut, looking like very nice, clean-cut schoolboys. But inside, there's a fold-out taken about a week before they committed the murders. And they're sitting with about four or five other kids. And in that picture, when you look at the face of Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, they're looking down. You can see the darkness. You can see they have company. You can see what's at work. It is eerie. Saul, hating God's anointed. David, having the Messiah in his loins. Satan, aware, no doubt, of God's plan. An evil spirit comes upon Saul, and he prophesied. Now, this word prophesied in verse 10 in the Hebrew is never used of prophecy, the prophecy of God. It's the word that means to babble, to rage, or that he raved. It has nothing to do with, it's never used for prophecy in the sense of God's word. Saul is overcome by the spirit and begins to rage. He begins to rave in the midst of the house. And David played with his hand, as at other times. David said, quick, let me get my guitar, see if I can calm this guy down. And there was a javelin in Saul's hand. Now, this is going to become a bad sign to David as time goes on. And Saul, cast the javelin, for he said, I will smite David even to the wall with it. I think that's what I'll do. I don't like this song. And David avoided out of his presence. It's an interesting word to me, twice. I'd have avoided out of his presence once and been gone. I don't know if David came back. It says that he loved Saul. He must have thought, well, he was overcome. David probably ran back, started to play the guitar again. He got away twice. And look what it says in verse 12. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him. Now, I don't feel that way when people are throwing spears at me. Isn't that interesting? The Lord is with David. David's a guy who's ducking spears. What do you mean the Lord's with me? No thanks. If this is the Lord with me, I'll take the Lord not with me. If the Lord with me is ducking spears, what is the Lord not with me? Relaxing? Here is Saul trying to kill David, and it says that he's afraid of David because he sees that the Lord is with him. That's hard to tell from someone else by outward observation, because there's David ducking spears, and it says he was departed from Saul. Therefore Saul removed him from him, and he made him his captain over 1,000, and he went out and came in before the people. He puts David in charge of a military host, no doubt hoping that he'll meet with his death in some confrontation with the Philistines. And David, here it is again, behaved himself wisely in all his ways, and the Lord was with him. David, there's no sin on David's part. David has laid his life on the line for the armies of Israel, for the glory of God. David has been faithful. David is not chafing under the responsibility of bearing armor or playing his instrument. He's not saying, I'm destined for greater things, and yet his life is being threatened already. David behaved himself very wisely in all his ways. The Lord was with him. Wherefore, when Saul saw that he behaved himself wisely, that he prospered, he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he went out and came in before them. The idea is in victory, leading the army. And Saul said to David, behold, my elder daughter, Merab, her will I give thee to wife. Only be thou valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles. For Saul said, let not my hand be on him, but let the hand of the Philistines be on him. So Saul says, I know, thou promise this guy my daughter and say, but do me this favor, go on out and fight the Philistines for me, hoping that David will get killed in the front of the battle. Now, sadly, many years later, David will do the same thing with Uriah the Hittite and send him in the battle where he'll die, the husband of Bathsheba. And David said unto Saul, who am I? And what is my life or my father's family in Israel that I should be the son-in-law to the king, even a crazy king? There's true humility on David's part. But it came to pass at that time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given unto Adriel, the Mahalite, to be wife. So Saul makes him the promise and then gives her to somebody else anyway. And maybe verse 20 is and 21 are an indication of why. And Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David. And they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. Here's why. And Saul said, I will give him her, that she may be a snare unto him. What a kid this must be. And that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Saul's thinking now, if the Philistines don't get him, Michal will. This is double trouble for David now. I know what I'll do. I'll give him this other one that nobody else wants, and she'll be a snare to him. Wherefore Saul said to David, thou shalt this day be my son-in-law in the one of the twain. And Saul commanded his servants, saying, commune with David secretly, and say, behold, the king has delight in thee. Go on down there, put on the big act, tell him I'm delighted in him. And all his servants love thee. Now, therefore, be the king's son-in-law. I want you to get involved here. Saul really loves you. His family loves you. The servants love you. And Saul's servants spake those words in the ears of David. And David said, does it seem like a light thing to you? Which is the way of saying, you know, this is a heavy thing to be the king's son-in-law, seeing that I am a poor man and lightly esteemed. And the servants of Saul told him, saying, on this manner spake David. And Saul said, thus shall you say to David, the king desireth not any dowry, but 100 foreskins of the Philistines. Things have changed, huh? He doesn't want a normal dowry, I'll say. But 100 foreskins of the Philistines to be avenged of the king's enemies. But Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. Now, obviously, because the men of Israel were circumcised, for David to bring back 100 foreskins meant that he had to go out and slay Philistines or Ammonites or the enemies. He had to go to battle for this. And Saul is hoping to put him in such a precarious position that he'll be killed. So he says, yeah, the king doesn't want a dowry. This is what he wants. And when his servants told David these words, it pleased David well. Things have changed. To be the king's son-in-law, and the days were not expired. Wherefore David arose, he went, he and his men, and slew of the Philistines 200 men. And David brought their foreskins, and they gave them in full tally to the king, that he might be the king's son-in-law. So he gives them twice as much as he asked for. And Saul gave him Michal, his daughter. What else could he do? To be his wife. And Saul saw, notice, and knew. He saw and knew that the Lord was with David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him. And Saul was yet the more afraid of David, and Saul became David's enemy continually. Now, it's very interesting as you follow the word afraid through the chapter, because it increases in intensity. And by the time Saul is afraid of David, he's paranoid, he watches him, then Saul is afraid of David where there's genuine fear, and now this word means to be tortured. There's madness attached to this. He is terrified of David in the sense that his heart is tortured. And each time he makes an attempt to take David's life, it says in that time period, he is seeing the fact that the Lord is with David, and yet he, going against that very fact, is trying to kill David. And at this point, it says he is yet the more afraid of David. Now that he's had this great victory, his daughter loves him. Then the princes of the Philistines went forth, and it came to pass, after they went forth, that David behaved himself more wisely than all of the servants of Saul, so that his name was much set by, or the idea is, it was very precious in Israel. Read ahead. We are heading into a very interesting time period in the life of David. In the next chapter, Saul will speak to his son Jonathan and swear to Jonathan that he won't touch a hair on David's head. And yet by the time we're 13, 14 verses into the chapter, twice again Saul tries to pin David to the wall. David will flee to his house, and his wife Michal is there, and she will say to David, "David, if you stay here, my father's going to have you killed." And she helps David slide out a window and escape, and she takes a big idol that she has, and we don't know why David allowed that, lays the idol in the bed, covers his head up with goat's hair, and pulls the blanket up. And Saul's servants come to kill David, and she says, "Look at him, he's sick." And they look in and think, "Man, he looks bad. I don't know if David's head looked like a goat," but they looked in, and he's white as a ghost, and they go back and tell Saul, "Man, he's bad, he's in bed, he's sick, he's contagious, we didn't want to go in." Saul says, "If you're afraid to touch him, bring the bed here, and I'll kill him." And they go back. And they go in and find out it's an idol, it's a statue. And they bring Michal, Saul's daughter, back to Saul. And Saul says, "What have you done?" She said, "David threatened my life. He said if I didn't do it, he would kill me." And she betrays David. So now his position is gone, his home is gone, his wife is gone. And when you have that many things falling apart in your life, it's easy for us to read, but how much stress is it when someone here gets fired and their job is gone and no income? And how much stress is it when all of a sudden someone's marriage is gone? We deal with it. We see the pain and the struggle. And then the home is gone. When those things go on, you need a counselor. So David goes to Samuel. He's with Samuel a little time and the armies of Saul come. Then he has to flee from Samuel, because God strips Samuel out of his life, because there are times when it is not God's will for any counselor on earth to be able to fix us, because God is taking us to the cave of Adullam. And nobody, no matter how much wisdom they have, would be able to counsel us out of a mandatory course that God is bringing into our lives. From Samuel, he finds Jonathan again. They go through a whole process where God finally takes Jonathan. Now his only and best friend is ripped out of his life. He flees to Nob, to the priest, to Ahimelech, and lies to Ahimelech, and ends up fleeing to Gath with Goliath's sword, forgotten all about his sling. And when he realizes, "I must be out of my mind. I'm in Gath. Everybody's saying to me, 'Aren't you the guy they sung the song about, that big hit up in Israel? Saul has slain his thousands, David has slain his 10,000. He's going, "Oh," he said, "well, that's a good idea. Maybe I'm out of my mind. I'll act like I'm out of my mind." And he says he starts to go around Gath, scratching on the doors and drooling on his beard, letting spit run down his face. And Achish, the king of Gath, says, "What are you bringing this guy to me for? I'm in government. Do I need one more madman around here? What do I want to do? What do you guys want me to do? Take him home and let him live in my house? Get him out of here." And they throw David out of Gath, and he ends up in this cave in Adullam, where he can sit and look out the front of the cave and see the Elah Valley, where all of this process began. And God will slowly strip everything out of his life, and it's there in Adullam where David will write at least 4 Psalms. For the first time, David again will look to heaven, and he'll say, Lord, when I was a youth and I sat in the fields, I had nothing, but I had everything. I looked up and I knew the heavens declare the glory of the Lord, and the earth showeth forth his handiwork. Night unto night they utter their speech. I looked up, Lord, and I said, Lord, our Lord, how excellent is thy name. Set thy glory above the heavens, and out of the mouths of babes and sucklings thou hast perfected praise. When I consider the sun and the moon and stars, the work of thy fingers, what is man that thou art mindful of him, or the son of man that thou visitest him? O God, when my heart was lifted up to you and I looked to you, I had nothing, but I had everything. And now, Lord, my position is gone, my home is gone, my wife is gone. My spiritual mentor is gone. My best friend is gone. My dignity is gone. But Lord, you're not gone. And I'll write those words, one thing. very important phrase, one thing have I desired of the Lord, and that will I seek after, that I might dwell all the days in the house of the Lord, that I might inquire in his temple, that I might behold his beauty. And we start to read the Psalms that are born out of there. We begin to see what God is doing in the heart of David, and a remarkable process begins. I want to encourage you.